this morning, and they're from Fort Atkinson High School. The students, please stand. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with us on a national award-winning program called Court with Class. And we have invited students from all the high schools in the state. They accept the invitation. They're sent the briefs that the council have written and have studied that and probably other materials and come to hear an oral argument with us. And in addition to listening to oral argument at noon, they will be joined by other students that are here today, and they will meet with the justice of our court. And today that justice is Justice Rogensack, who sits on the far left of the bench. And let me introduce the other members of the court. Seated next to Justice Rogensack is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right is an empty chair. And ordinarily, Justice Diane Sykes sits there. She will not be participating in this case because when she was a trial judge in Milwaukee, she handled a part of this case, so she will not participate. Let me call the case we're going to hear now, 02-1426, Glenn versus, is it Plant or Planty?
It's Plant.
Plant. And at the microphone?
Michael Russart, I represent Dr. Plant.
Right, good. Counsel, Mr. Russart, you can begin.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices. Mr. Brendel, ladies and gentlemen. Beginning this morning, starting from the premise that ALT is the current and sound law of the state of Wisconsin, that it represents the law with respect to what an expert's privilege is in the state of Wisconsin, and that is that an expert has a broad, qualified privilege to withhold testimony, that that privilege is founded in Section 90706 of the Wisconsin statutes, and that is based upon the court's interpretation that a party has no greater power to compel an expert's involvement in a case than does the court. And this was a change from common law, the Filler case. And the primary change, I believe, is that Filler required experts to testify about previously formed opinions. And ALT recognized that 90706 allows an expert to withhold those opinions. I believe that the trial court in this case erred when it interpreted ALT and 90706. And the error can be found on page 11 of its decision, which is on page 126 of our appendix to our brief. And the error is that the trial court believed that Dr. Acosta and ALT could be compelled to provide an existing opinion as to his role as a treating physician. And when you look at ALT at page 90, paragraph 90, 36, it's very clear that the court determined that Dr. Acosta, while being unique with respect to being a treating physician and being required to testify about his observations, did not have to testify about his opinions. And that is further emphasized on page 91 in paragraph 38, where the court recognizes a change from Filler in that experts are no longer required to provide existing opinions.
Counselor, I realize we're applying ALT, and in my view, ALT sets up three steps. The first, whether what you're asked for is opinion. The second step, whether or not this expert opinion is something that would require additional study or something you already know from where you are. And then the third step is, if it is something you already know without any additional study, and there are compelling circumstances, then doesn't that limit the scope of the privilege that the doctor has?
Well, that's
under
ALT. That's an exception to the privilege. The privilege is that the doctor, or the physician in this case, doesn't have to provide his opinion. If the steps are met and that it is an expert opinion and that it wouldn't require him or her to do additional work, and there are compelling circumstances insofar as he or she is uniquely necessary to the case, then that expert could be compelled to testify.
Okay, so what I'd like you to focus on for me is that third step, because it seems to me that's where this case turns or doesn't turn, is whether the fact that this was a treating physician is sufficient in and of itself to be a compelling circumstances requiring us to limit that privilege, or whether there is anything else that can be identified or has been identified. That issue I want you to look at. And then secondly, I want you to tell me whether a determination of whether there is compelling circumstances is a determination the court makes as a finding of fact or a conclusion of law at the trial court level.
All right. The first issue with respect to whether a treating physician, that status makes the expert uniquely necessary. And we learn from ALT that that's not the case. The two cases, the present case and ALT, are very similar in the fact that they both involve treating physicians, they both involve obstetricians, and in ALT, Dr. Acosta was recognized as a treating physician to not be uniquely necessary with respect to the question asked, and that his role as a treating physician put him in no special standing with respect to his opinions on the question asked. So you have to look to the question asked. And in this case, the question being asked is there a liability on behalf of Dr. Plant? And again, like Dr. Acosta, where the question went to liability, Dr. Koh's role as a treating physician doesn't place him in any special circumstances. He's not unique because of that. His medical reports, any deposition that would be taken of him, which would report his findings or his observations, could be used by any other expert, any other qualified physician, any other qualified obstetrician, to make a determination as to standard of care, whether Dr. Plant acted reasonably. So as to the question asked, Dr. Koh, like Dr. Acosta in ALT, is not unique. There are any number of experts who could fill that role. The second question, as to whether a determination of compelling circumstances is a question of fact or a rule of law, I think this is one of those areas where that's a blurred there's no clear answer to that. This is one of those where it's an in-between. You have to look at the facts of the circumstances and determine whether those facts are compelling. So I think you end up with a rule of law, but you have to look at the facts to make that determination. So I think you first have to make a finding of fact, what the compelling circumstances are, and then apply those facts to the law and determine whether those are compelling. In this case, the circumstances surround the mistake made by the Glenn's counsel in not naming experts in a timely fashion. And as a sanction, in lieu of granting Dr. Plant's initial motion to dismiss, the trial court, Judge Amato, ruled that the plaintiffs would be sanctioned for their failure to timely name witnesses, and their sanction would be that they would be limited to the two witnesses that were in their witness report that was filed belatedly, Dr. Koh and a Dr. Chung. The plaintiffs later on withdrew Dr. Chung. He was a damage witness. But Judge Amato's order was very clear that Dr. Koh would be the only liability expert upon which the plaintiffs could rely. So, the facts that led them to that circumstance, the fact that it was in Judge Amato's mind an inexcusable neglect in not naming experts timely, because at the time, Judge Amato had the choice of extending the time for the plaintiffs to name witnesses. There was a motion before him on that issue. And Judge Amato determined that there was no excusable neglect for extending the deadline after the time for the deadline had expired. And so the inexcusable neglect of failing to timely name witnesses and having a sanction imposed where the plaintiffs are then left with one expert should not be compelling circumstances to compel an unwilling expert to testify. If you look at the circumstances which brought Dr. Koh to the place he is today, I think that you can recognize, if you look at the record carefully, you can recognize how it is that he got thrust into the throes of this litigation. There's a letter written.
Let me interrupt you for a minute, because you just used the term, and rightfully so, compelling circumstances. Do you think that term is broad enough so that a court, in deciding whether there are compelling circumstances, should look at what the result might be otherwise for the plaintiff? In other words, in this case, the result would be a dismissal. So do you think that that term is broad enough to encompass the court looking at that?
No, I think that the term the court has to look at most closely is the uniquely necessary aspect of the expert. And I think that factor cannot be a result of what the litigants do, but it has to be a factor that's inherent to the witness itself. In other words, Dr. Koh is now uniquely necessary because of the sanction imposed by the court. And the sanction was imposed because of the mistake made by the plaintiff's counsel. You can't have compelling circumstances created by the litigants. Otherwise, you'd have the litigants divining circumstances to create opportunities to force experts, otherwise unwilling experts, to testify. You'd be taking the privilege and throwing it out the window.
So you think compelling circumstances should be limited to the idea of uniquely necessary? Am I reading you correctly?
I think if you look at the Ault case, that those two terms were meant to be used interchangeably, and that the compelling circumstances are not related to what the outcome of the case is going to be, but what compels the expert to be uniquely necessary. And you can look at other cases that have studied this in other jurisdictions. For example, let's take the Karp versus Cooley case. It's a Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals case, a federal case that looked at 706, Rule 706. And in that case, the Court of Appeals upheld a trial court's decision not to compel an expert to testify. It was a case where it was a case about an artificial heart, and the expert was Dr. Michael DeBakey, a world-renowned cardiologist. And he wasn't forced to provide opinions. When he was confronted with having to testify, he said, "I'm not going to answer that question. I don't want to testify. I'm not going to provide my expert opinion." And in that case, the court rightfully held that it wasn't going to compel Dr. DeBakey because, in its view, he had no relevant information to provide. And the reason he had no relevant information to provide is because he refused to answer the questions. So I think what you have to do is you have to look at what makes the witness uniquely necessary. In that case, another court, using our Ault case, might have said, "Dr. DeBakey, you're uniquely necessary. There are very few people in this world who could testify about the effects that an artificial heart could have on a human being. You're one of those people that are developing these mechanisms. We need you to testify."
Counsel? As I see this case, we are here to define what is a compelling circumstance under Ault. That's the way I see it now. You can, and I base that on the holding of Ault set forth 224 with second 89. Paragraph 35, midway in the paragraph. "Accordingly, we hold that absent a showing of compelling circumstances, an expert cannot be compelled to give expert testimony whether the inquiry asks for the expert's existing opinion or would require further work. In addition to demonstrating a compelling need for the expert's testimony, the party seeking the testimony must present a plan of reasonable compensation and et cetera. But I focus on what the first sentence in the holding is. We hold that absent a showing of compelling circumstances. And I think this case is about how do we define compelling circumstances. I'm following up on Justice Crooks's case because I sense maybe that's where he also, or at least in part, saw it. Is that how you see the issue in this case?
Well, I think that's one of the issues, but I think that the court itself explains later on in that same paragraph, the last sentence in the paragraph that goes from page 89 to 90, it says that we believe that this approach, the approach of the qualified broad privilege, strikes a balance between a litigant's need for irreplaceable or unique testimony, and there they're defining what compelling circumstances would be, and the expert's right to be free from compulsion.
But I guess I don't read Ault as necessarily interchangeably using unique testimony as the same as a compelling circumstance. Unique testimony may be a compelling circumstance. I mean, it may meet a showing of compelling circumstance, or it may not, given the facts of the case. Do you disagree with me, or you agree with me?
Respectfully, I do, Your Honor. I believe that...
Respectfully disagree with me.
I respectfully disagree with you. I think that if the court meant other things to be compelling, it would have stated so in that paragraph. Instead, when it talks about that absent a showing of compelling circumstances, whether the inquiry asks for existing opinions or other work, the expert has a right not to testify. And in fact, it says that this approach strikes a balance between the litigant's need for irreplaceable or unique testimony and the right to be free from compulsion. So, I understand your position, but I respectfully disagree. I believe that the terms are interchangeable, and they were meant to be interchangeable.
Okay. So, for unless we change all, you're saying that it has to that.
If I may,
this unique. Unique equals compelling under Ault. It has to be it has to be unique testimony under Ault.
But what I'm saying is that for it to be a compelling circumstance, it has to be a circumstance about the witness, not a circumstance about a procedural aspect of the case.
Well, isn't that what we're here to determine? Again, maybe I'm wrong, that Ault set forth the test, as Justice Rokensack indicated, and now we are here to put more meat on the bone and legally define parameters of what a compelling circumstance may be.
Yes.
You agree with that?
Absolutely. I think that, like many privileges that have been developed over the course of time, many issues that come before this case, it's the exercise of those privileges that eventually define the parameters of the privilege. And I think that the exercise of the privilege here has led us to this forum, and we are talking about, rightfully so, whether it's whether compelling circumstances should be that which is created by a litigant's mistake or neglect, or whether it is something about the witness, the uniqueness of the witness, that requires compulsion of that expert in any given case. We can't escape the fact that there would have been a universe of experts that the plaintiff could have relied on had they not missed the initial scheduling order deadline. or sought relief from that scheduling order deadline and been granted relief. And so it is only through their own machinations that we're in the position we're in.
I mean, you want us to define, to put meat on the bone of compelling circumstance, to define compelling circumstance in this sense, what it is not. It is not when the circumstance is brought about by the dastardly deeds of the person seeking relief. I mean, that's how you want us to define compelling circumstances.
Absolutely.
Counselor, I have a little different question for you. Are any of the claims the plaintiff makes sustainable without expert testimony? And I would ask you to think about, there's some language in the complaint about a lack of informed consent. And there are different levels of proof required for that claim depending on how that claim is characterized. Focusing on that, could the claim for lack of informed consent be maintained in this case without expert medical testimony?
I believe that Dr. Koh would be required to testify to medical opinions about causation with respect to what the informed consent, what effect it had on her as an individual. And without expert opinion testimony, I don't think even the informed consent claim could go forward.
Thank you.
Counsel, I see that I have before me a certification that is probably going to visit our desks shortly. A certification from Judges Deininger, Dyckman, and Higginbotham regarding interpretation of Burnett versus Ault. Are you familiar, and if this deals with, does the privilege against compelled expert testimony set forth in Burnett extend to a defendant physician in a medical malpractice case? And does the privilege extend to non-party nurses employed by a defendant hospital in medical malpractice action? Are you familiar with any other cases currently on appeal or in the status of possibly seeking petition for review here that deal with the issue of how we define compelling circumstance?
Or how you interpret the expert privilege. I think I'm not sure that the cases that you cited to with respect to the certification are actually wondering what the parameters of compelling circumstances. I think those cases deal more whether or not they're entitled to the privilege.
That's right. And that's why I read the questions, because those don't know. Right. I'm just...
I don't know of it.
Don't deal with the issue that we have here before us necessarily, and that is this a compelling circumstance under Ault versus Klein? Are there any other cases that you're aware of that are in the pipeline that present the issue that we have before us? How do you define compelling circumstance?
Not that I'm aware of, and I you know, turn to the amicus briefs that were filed by two of the major attorney groups that represent both the plaintiff and defense bar, and the cases you cited to with respect to certification were discussed in the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers brief. I'm sure if there were other cases, they would have included them in their brief. I believe this is the only case that has arisen with respect to this issue. And again, because there are other cases out there in the pipeline, I don't think it means that the court strayed too far in Ault, or that it was mistaken in Ault, or it didn't go far enough in Ault. I think what it means is that there's a privilege out there, like a muscle. It's being exercised. As you exercise it, it becomes better defined.
I seem to discern from your comments that self-created compelling circumstances are not good enough. Let me just try to create a hypothetical. Suppose the plaintiff clearly identified an expert witness, had the expert witness, and the night before the expert witness was to testify at trial, he has a heart attack and dies, or she has a heart attack and dies. Compelling circumstances?
Absolutely. Justice Prosser, I just recently was involved in a case in Kenosha County where that happened twice, where the plaintiff's expert first died just before we were to take his deposition. And as a matter of courtesy, knowing that the court would grant relief, I told the plaintiff, please go find another expert. The second expert he identified was diagnosed with Alzheimer's just before his deposition. And again, understanding that the court would grant him relief to name another expert, I extended him the same opportunity. He named another expert, and the case eventually went to trial.
How was that expert?
How was the third expert?
Yes, did he survive?
He was healthy. Unfortunately for my client, he was too healthy.
Could you identify anything else that you would consider a compelling circumstance?
You know, I've thought about this for a long time, obviously. I anticipated hearing that question, and quite frankly, the only thing that I can determine that would make a circumstance compelling is a factor related to the witness. How unique is that witness? And what happened to that witness that made him unavailable, for example? Are those compelling circumstances? But clearly, as in this case where the instances are created by the litigant, those cannot be compelling, and the Court of Appeals decision can't be allowed to stand. It would throw all out the window, and it would allow litigants to be unscrupulous or lazy and just not be the type of practice that we want to promote.
Counselor, I'm a little confused by your answer to Justice Prosser's question, because he put the hypothetical that if the witness dies, is that compelling circumstances? And you said yes, but what you really responded to was that you would just agree to extend the deadline to get another witness, not permit a witness who didn't want to testify to be compelled to testify. So I'm a little confused by your response.
Well, clearly the dead witness can't be compelled to testify. I mean, so if you then take a treating witness and say he's now going to be my expert witness,
right.
You know, I think under those circumstances, no, there's nothing unique about that witness. There would be nothing unique about that treating physician, a Dr. Koh, for example. Again, he is not unique. He's not irreplaceable. There's nothing about him that makes him unique so as to compel his testimony. You know, maybe I did mislead you, and I'm sorry if I did, but the circumstance where a witness would die would be circumstances compelling to allow a court to extend a deadline to name an additional witness.
What if the court said, this case has been postponed for the third time, and it's going to trial, and that's it, period? And you have the expert witness that's retained to testify die a couple days beforehand. The treating physician wanted to exercise under Ault versus Klein a privilege not to testify. The case is going to trial, and counsel says, for the plaintiff, says to the judge, hey, judge, this is a compelling circumstance. The case is going to trial. We would like the treating physician, within the confines of Ault versus Klein, to be called as a witness. Is that a compelling circumstance?
Well, just as I see my time is up.
You may respond.
I would think, again, it's not, because that witness is not unique. That witness, again, if you focus on what characteristics and quality that witness has, they're replaceable.
They're replaceable for the trial that's going to start 2 days from now?
Under those circumstances, if the treating expert has invoked Ault previously, you don't know what he's going to say. I mean, I don't think that a court would allow a trial to begin where they don't know whether or not the plaintiff has proof of their case or not. So
in this case, I mean, perhaps you have records, in fact, where the doctor has opined about, again, not required to make further opinions, not required to do any additional research, but has made an opinion. It's appearing in the records. All the doctor has to do is show up and state what he's already stated to the patient and put in his records, get paid and go home.
Well, under the fact, if you're likening it to this case, I don't think that Dr. Koh's opinions amount to an opinion on negligence to begin with. Unwarranted, unnecessary, those don't amount to unreasonable. And we don't know what Dr. Koh's opinion is on that with respect to that. He has not, in fact, his latest record on that issue says that Dr. Plant's care may not meet the standard of care.
So if death the night before of your only witness isn't compelling, my guess is you think that, I don't know what is. What is compelling?
I certainly would expect that the death the night before trial would entail an adjournment from the trial court. So I don't think that
I'm saying no. The judge, you know, I used to be Ken. Well, I didn't. Maybe Justice Crooks did every once in a while. But, you know, so it's going to trial. It's been, you know, period.
Again, I don't think that the expert would be irreplaceable. You'd have to go out and find another expert.
In 2 days. Okay. That's your position.
That's
so
correct.
Really nothing is compelling. Hmm?
Well, no.
Give me an example of something.
Irreplaceable and unique testimony. Someone who is a leading expert in something.
Death doesn't do it. What
let's turn to the Kaufman versus Edelstein case, another federal court case that was an antitrust case with respect to the computer industry. The government wanted experts in the computer industry to testify. There was an argument about whether these were the best available experts to the government, and should they be compelled to testify. The court ruled that they were basically irreplaceable and should be compelled to testify. So where you have a developing area of technology, developing area of science, you have somebody who has been the foremost expert in an area. Another case, the Wright versus Jeep case.
I didn't have many developing science cases in Marathon County when I was a circuit court judge brought by the federal government. Maybe others didn't, but I did. But I had a lot of what would, I don't want to be personal injury cases. I won't use any vernacular. Personal injury cases. In that kind of a personal injury case, whether it be med mal or just a regular auto accident case, and that, give me an example of a compelling circumstance in the run-of-the-mill kind of cases that appear in the courts in this state.
Well, if you're out in a rural community and it would be, you wouldn't be able to afford to bring in an expert, I don't know. I'm saying that I think you have to look at the circumstances surrounding the characteristics of the expert itself to determine whether those are compelling.
We're going to have time in rebuttal. Maybe you can give me an example of what would be a kind of case that would appear in our courts in this state. I'll ask you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Russert. We'll have the passing of the microphone. Thank you. Try the other side of your jacket. That might make it easier for you. Okay. Good. Well, you just passed your first test, Mr. Brendel.
Thank you.
John K. Brendel, representing Sonora and Christopher Glenn.
Yes. Good morning, Justices. At the outset, what I'd like to do is just take a minute or two to set the record straight with regard to my trust in that the experts were set in the case that of the circuit court. Initially,
I'm having a little trouble.
We may have a change of batteries of the microphone system.
Compelling circumstances.
If and when you arrive after March, we should have our new sound system. Thank you, counsel. You may proceed.
What I was saying, Justice, is that I'd just like to take a minute or two to set the record straight on how I got involved in this thing and why I believed I had witnesses that were prepared and ready to testify, so that everybody is familiar with that fact. I know you've read the briefs and you're familiar with all of the circumstances with the change of justices, and I'm not going to get into that and waste time. But I do think that you should be made aware of exactly, excuse me, what happened. Mrs. Glenn and her husband came to me in late December of 98, told me that Dr. Coe was outraged with what he had seen that had happened to her, told her to get an attorney, said he would testify as to the malpractice, and even suggested that she go to see Dr. David Nash, who was in the same building, and should be given the entire file, and he would back up Dr. Coe. He was upset and angry, and he was going to, and urging her to go to get an attorney. I refused, even then, unless I would get a written report giving evidence of Dr. Nash's concurrence with Dr. Coe, as I was told he was so angry about. I got that and prepared.
Also, I just want to ask a question.
Surely.
Is this part of the record, or this is not part of the record, is it?
Yes, there's affidavits on behalf of.
Oh, okay. So this, what we're hearing is part of this record that we have.
Yes, Mrs. Glenn filed an affidavit in this record indicating all of these things that I'm basically telling you.
Okay, I just wanted to check. All right, thank you.
Okay. Despite, I then got the complaint prepared, got it filed within 2 days after I got the report from Dr. David Nash. Statute of limitations, at least the 3-year statute, was going to toll within a couple of days, and I did it. Despite my efforts thereafter, I never had a meeting with Dr. Coe or got to talk to him. I never got past his secretary. He never once told me that he would not testify. And on the contrary, Mrs. Glenn was reassured on follow-up visits by Dr. Coe that he was still upset and that he was going to testify for her. Then, after my meeting with Dr. Nash regarding preparation for a deposition that I was going to take about from Dr. Plant, and also Dr. Arena, I was first advised by him, and was very helpful, very nice, that he didn't want to testify against a local doctor. I did move Judge Amato for leave under the circumstances to name a substitute. Judge Amato, in his decision and his oral discussion, indicated that I was to file a report from Dr. Coe because Dr. Coe was in the best position to judge whether there was malpractice.
Counsel, can I just ask a question?
Yes.
Because I read some of the record, but perhaps not the first part. But in the record, as I recall, it said that Dr. Coe offered to provide names of out-of-state experts who would testify as to the standard of care. Is that correct?
No. Not well, yes and no.
Oh. That's in the record. So you're saying that is not correct?
There's also in the record that he said that we had a meeting. We never had a meeting. And that's an affidavit of my part in letters and correspondence to the circuit judges and the Court of Appeals that are in those records. I don't know where he got that from, but the only time that he recommended somebody, which was, I think, a Dr. Miller in Illinois, that was after the fact that Dr. Nash could not testify according to Judge Amato. His position was that because he was a treating physician, he would prefer to have somebody else cooperate, that he was not as good in testifying because he might be construed as being biased, and he mentions that in a letter to the court, that he might be construed as being biased, and therefore he wanted a backup doctor. When we made the motion to substitute for Dr. Nash, I never frankly thought it would be a problem. It was a problem, and Judge Amato put that limitation that I get this record showing in what his position was from Dr. Coe, which he did comply with. Dr. Coe has never indicated officially, and there's nothing in this record other than a couple of letters which imply that he doesn't want to testify, that he won't testify. Everything I've heard from my client and the letters that I got were simply, it was one, for example, for a trial date. And he wrote to me and it simply said, I will be in China that month. Nothing more. Nothing that I will not testify. That, I believe, is in the record as well.
That was the reason for my question, because I was going to say, well, if he offered to provide you with the names of people, my next question is, why didn't you take him up on his offer?
He gave me the name of one doctor. This was after the fact, after Dr. Amato, Judge Amato said that there will be nobody else but Dr. Koh. I did write to this Dr. Miller, who didn't respond. But this was only one name, and it was only afterwards. As to the missed date for naming witnesses, of course, I regret that that happened. But I did take immediate steps, even though it was Christmas, to rectify that by filing the witness list and the other documents that I was no longer understood that was still being required of me initially. Judges of the two lower courts have so far said that such a mistake did not constitute, and it certainly did, I do not believe, intentional or egregious conduct of some kind or another.
Counselor, why was it that you thought that the scheduling order in this case was not in effect and you did not have to name your witnesses on September 23rd?
The primary reason, in my recollection, is that it was my experience over the last almost 50 years that every time a new judge is appointed, they usually run their own court and they have their own scheduling conference requests, just as Justice or Judge White did at the end. This happened so quickly with these judges being changed that it just didn't dawn on me that the one that was done, the conference that was done, even before we had the medical malpractice session, would still be in place. I guess I overlooked it, but I thought that with the repeated changes of judges, I'm going to get another postcard in the mail indicating that there's going to be a new date. I was apparently wrong in that assumption, but as soon as I found out about it, it was corrected. What else I was going to mention?
Also, I have one more question for you. Are there any of your claims that can be maintained without expert opinion testimony, in your view?
Well, that was one of the points I was going to bring up in this discussion, because, frankly, the one regarding whether she was adequately informed is one that I've asked around on and nobody seems to know. I've read the jury instructions, of course, and they're very broad. And in this particular case, this young lady claims to have been told by the doctor that if she has this hysterectomy, she will feel like a 16-year-old girl again and be totally free of pain and have no other symptoms or problems other than she will have to take estrogen. Now, if there's any women on the jury or any husbands who had women went through that experience with the new symptoms that arise after menopause, it's conceivable that they could come to their own conclusion without any further expert testimony. And most times, even with that question, you have experts there who will probably testify that that's reasonable. That's not adequately informing a woman. In fact, that's falsely informing a woman. And I don't know what the thing is. I believe one would not be required to put an expert in. But I've asked around, and nobody seems to know what the answer to that question is.
Thank you.
Counsel indicates that you shouldn't be responsible for recalling compelling circumstances. Well, no attorney is going to intentionally put himself or herself in a position where there's going to be a problem that he causes. Sometimes problems happen. I can name a couple that the defense did wrong, which I won't. But there's no affidavit on the part of the defense or anyone. This is an insurance company trying to get the treating doctor not to be able to testify. It's not Dr. Koh himself saying, I don't want to testify as such. And he's not rendering the plea, give me the privilege. I want to extend the privilege. I'm going to use my privilege. He's not been heard from. And there's nothing really specific in the record that say he wouldn't show up and testify. In fact, the letter in the record says that given other circumstances where I wasn't the treating doctor, I'd be happy to pick up their file and go in there and testify.
Well, but, and that's true, that I think that Dr. Koh could come and testify to what he saw and he did, but isn't the expert testimony as to the standard of care? That's the one he didn't want to testify on, right?
He'll testify to anything. He just does. He just felt that he was upset because his corroborator, Dr. Nash, was let off the hook and wasn't going to be there to back him up.
I guess in my question, and now if the record is as you define it, I just was reciting what I understood from the record. But I understood that after he informed you that he would prefer not to testify, that he gave you some names. And then my question was, well, why didn't you take him up on that? Now you've explained that, well, you did. He only gave you one name, and you tried to get Dr. Miller, and he didn't come. But I wanted to – there is a distinction here between what Dr. Cole could come and say and then what he didn't want to testify, I believe, is to this, you know, the expert part as to the standard of care.
Well, there's one very major point that perhaps you're overlooking. And that is that Dr. Amato, when he made this ruling that Dr. Koh was the best one to testify, he's in the best position, he's seen the scars, he knows whether they're old, new, where they're located, etc., that he was in the best position. Therefore, he was not going to, and made it very clear, he was not going to let another doctor testify. So I could have gotten Dr. Miller after this is all after the fact now. Now, that's when I heard about Dr. Miller. I could have got these doctors, and he still wouldn't let them testify. All I would be doing is spending the plaintiff's money. I did write to him and contact him in hopes that soon I'd get another judge, and then I'd move right in and try and get that done. But it never happened until it went back to Judge White. And at that time, suddenly before that meeting came up, the scheduling conference that she had ordered, an injunction gets laid on me, one that was signed in October but didn't appear before any of the courts until January 27th or something, 2 days before the scheduling conference, as I remember, which then put the case in limbo again because it was unclear whether Dr. Plant was a part of this HMO that was restrained or not.
Counsel, just for clarification, are you asserting that there's nothing in the record that demonstrates Dr. Cole is asserting the privilege?
Yes. There's a letter, I believe, in which he said he makes claim that he told me that he wasn't going to testify or something, which I'm indicating to you that both the client and myself take serious issue with and filed affidavit. It's just not true.
Let me.
But that in itself, if you constitute that as an expression of his privilege, then I'm wrong.
Again, just for my clarification, is it your position there's nothing in the record indicating that Dr. Cole is raising his privilege not to testify?
That is true. There is nothing in the record that said he's raising it. There is something
invoking it. I don't want to get hung up on the verb. Is he invoking his privilege not to testify?
I know of no place in the record where he said that he is invoking his privilege. There are things in the record that says he's upset, said he had told me he didn't want to testify as an expert, but there's nothing in the record that says he's invoking a privilege not to testify.
Well, then, are you ready to go to trial?
With him? Sure.
So why are we here today?
Because the insurance company is making a claim indicating that Dr. Cole says he doesn't want to testify, and therefore, you should throw him out so he can't testify.
Okay, so now we go to, let's suppose you win here. You say you're ready to go to trial. All the depositions have been taken?
Dr. Koh's deposition was going to be taken by the defense on several occasions. Everything got postponed. It never got happening. And then the injunction came in.
But he did not send a letter or counsel that said, I'm invoking my privilege and I'm not coming to the deposition?
Heavens no.
Okay. So we finish the deposition, theoretically, and he comes in and he says, you can say one of two things, two, three things. He doesn't show up. He says, I'm not talking. I suppose that he would have to talk as treating physician, but he would then invoke the privilege on expert witness, on the expert opinion, as to the malpractice of the prior doctor. Right?
I would be amazed if he would do that. I do not think that will happen.
I'm amazed, but I mean it's possible, right? It's possible.
Anything's possible.
Trying to figure out what the scenarios might be, all right.
No, he was very angry about what he saw. He may pull no punches when he wrote the letter to Dr. or Judge Amato.
Well, he may come in and give a full deposition and give his expert testimony. Those are things that could happen. You want that to proceed, right?
Yes. I do not think that he's going to refuse to testify opinions or anything.
He'll be subpoenaed for the deposition?
If necessary, it would not surprise me if he shows up. To this day, he tells the client that there's no problem, that he's there. He's just like, oh, he was upset.
So what do you
want? I can't get to talk with him, frankly. I was trying to get in there the last 3 or 4 weeks even to try and get a visit with him.
Have you ever talked to him?
No. No, every time I get appointments set up the day or two before, I get canceled because he's...
Are you going to bring him on as a hostile witness?
Could I bring him on?
Oh, like a friendly witness.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't now, but I can't imagine that he would be hostile. He's talk about compelling circumstances. This doctor is the one that got this whole thing going. And it wasn't just because he was telling her that she has a case. He was angry. If he had just telling her that he had a case, as he seems to imply, there was no reason to send her to Dr. Nash, because she went to Dr. Nash with the records and so forth. One doctor saying you got a case would be more than enough. But no, he sent to Dr. Nash. Dr. Nash sends me the report. I figure these two fellows are talking to each other. We're running out of time. We filed a complaint. And then subsequently is when I find out that he's now upset because Dr. Nash is not going to be at his backside.
Okay. I'm sorry.
No, no. The reason I raised this is because I thought the issue before this case is basically that there was a passage of time when you didn't file your names, that the expert here was not going to testify, and that's why I asked the question to start this off. So you're saying that either the record is being misinterpreted, or I have misinterpreted the record, and that this did not happen.
Well, it's the insurance company that's presuming he's not going to testify because of the letters that he wrote to the court, that he was upset. But he's never claimed a privilege.
But you're just saying you've never talked to him either. So the hypotheticals that the Chief Justice is raising are certainly realistic. And you've tried to talk to him and he won't talk to you?
I've had appointments set with him several times. And a day or so before, he said, I get some indication he's got a lecture in someplace else and he won't be available.
Speculation, but it sounds like he maybe doesn't want to talk about this case. No.
This is not in the record, but I've been asking around what the problem is, and I find out he likes to take control of whatever is going on, and more so than the average person or physician. And when he got upset with Dr. Nash backing off, he's kind of making it tough.
So let's just assume for the moment that he is invoking his privilege. Just assume that. Because at least one issue that the court has explored is compelling circumstances. What do you view as compelling circumstances?
He's a very active party to this law litigation. He, in fact, urged it. He's pushed it. He's promised that he would testify for her. He gave her the name of another doctor who would back him up on his opinions. He's written to the court expressing all of those opinions in some length and showing that this young lady apparently had been guilty of malpractice by Dr. Plant. That makes him more than a passerby. I didn't pick him out of the yellow pages.
So the compelling circumstances from your perspective are that you've got a doctor who has led the patient and counsel to rely on him to go ahead with the malpractice suit in that he would testify, and you've placed reliance on that, and it's a little late in the day for you to have to find somebody else and allow him to back off. In other words, it's a kind of promise and reliance. He promised he'd be there. You relied, and there's detriment. Client relied, and there's detriment. It's sort of a promissory estoppel argument.
But it shouldn't be he who breaks his contract or something that has to answer for it. He's a willing doctor. He brought it up. He wants to help the young lady.
No, but now he's changed. I shouldn't say that, but we have to assume here he's changed his mind just to get over the hurdle that he's invoked the privilege.
Get over that assumption that you started with, yes.
Well, or maybe the argument is not promissory estoppel. I don't know that promissory estoppel is right, but a promissory thing. Maybe it's that he's waived his privilege.
Yes, I put that in as an argument in the brief, as I remember.
What other compelling circumstances are?
Well, I think the fact that the judge decided that instead of granting additional time by which you could get another witness implied and indicated that Dr. Koh was all we'd really need because he is the one that's hands-on type doctor that's there, and he's and the judge was made aware that it was that him at the outset, so he wanted to make sure, I guess, that that was the case, and that Dr. Koh did, in fact, write a letter. He, and he did say it many times in the reports that he wrote that he wants to help the girl. And that doesn't sound to me like somebody who wants to invoke a privilege and leave her hanging.
Well, I'm a little bit confused, only because when I asked the question about that he offered to, you know, give you other names, you mentioned, so he did, in other words, I'm understanding that he said, I prefer not the testimony, I don't want to testify or whatever, and he gave you the name of somebody, which would be an indication that he wanted someone else to testify on the standard of
that's
care.
That's a misassumption.
That's a misassumption.
Yes. What he did is say, he's always indicated that he wanted to testify, but if I couldn't use Dr. Nash, another backup would be Dr. Miller from Illinois. And I contacted Dr. Miller to be the backup, okay. Even though Judge Amato said, you can't bring anybody else. You're going to have to be stuck with Cope.
Right.
Just in case, as I said, I found another judge who was more lenient in that regard. And I don't know if you want me to go on with regard to compelling circumstances and some of the problems that I see with it or whatever. As it's been mentioned here, somebody's going to have to define what compelling circumstances mean. Because I don't think anybody really has a finger, a feel for it, totally what that entails. And you, frankly, in my opinion, you better grant exclusive distinction to the trial court judge to be prepared to handle a great deal of Court of Appeals and Supreme Court cases financed by defendant insurance companies. The trial court judges are in the best position, perhaps, to judge when they think compelling circumstances are involved. Even the Court of Appeals in this case, both of them, indicated that they felt compelling circumstances exist. And I think it could be a major problem for courts of appeals and Supreme Courts unless the local courts are given that jurisdiction, that power to determine in their mind when they see compelling circumstances and when they don't.
Counselor, do you think the determination of compelling circumstances is a finding of fact by the trial court, or do you think it's a conclusion of law by the trial court based on the facts of record?
I think it's a finding of fact, if I had to pick the two. I believe it'd be a finding of fact. There's going to be a lot of conflict that, as I see what the difference is between finding of fact and conclusion. I mean, this does more than just speak to doctors. This speaks to any expert. Somebody mentioned a car mechanic or something. Let's say you got a master mechanic. He's checked the car that's come in four or five times. He knows that it's not been altered or changed by the customer, but his boss who sold the car to him says, well, they must have been altered. That automobile is altered. That was a good car. We don't owe you anything. And the mechanic now knows that it was not altered because he's familiar with carburetors or whatever it was that was there. Now, if he knows that it's not altered, is that a fact or is that an opinion? If a doctor comes up to you and says, I think you've got a brain tumor that's malignant, and we're going to do some treatment, and later on you want to question him, is the fact that he reached that conclusion, is that a fact now or is that an opinion? He says it's my opinion, but after doing his study and his research, how do you determine if that's a fact or an opinion? Other than after the operation, maybe you can find out. But can't you be questioning him about that? Why did you reach this opinion? Or why did you come to this fact? I suppose somebody's going to ask the court system to make a decision about those things. And I could probably give you other examples. You mentioned something about sudden urgencies, witnesses. I think witness lists, for example, as we talked about, have to be modified somehow to provide for emergencies. You're going to have doctors changing their willingness to testify due to pressure from their HMOs. Are you going to put one HMO against the other HMO? Because this HMO, those doctors, as in this case, are not going to be allowed to testify. Here I took Dr. Arena's deposition in this case. I was told by the defense attorneys that he will not testify to any expert opinions. And I'm asking him expert opinions as to why he claims he told my lady not to get a hysterectomy, why it was bad. Couldn't answer that. So we went home. Later on, he's declared by them as an expert witness. Now I can go back and spend the money to take another deposition. I think if you're involved in any part of that litigation, you've got an active material interest in it, you should not be excusable under the privilege, frankly. If you're going to, we're going to have lots of trouble with HMOs. In HMOs, they refer you from one doctor to another, to the X-ray department, to the blood test department, and so forth. Now, if the defense attorney says, as it seems to be the case in some of these clinics, as was filed by the Trial Lawyers Association, we're not going to give out any opinions. Nobody's going to testify. So where are you going to get testimony? You're going to go to another HMO? Pretty soon they're going to get together and say, oh, no, we're not giving opinions. We can make more money here in the office. We don't want to get involved. We've had some intellectual property that we have as doctors. We're privileged. And you can extend that to chiropractors, maybe nurses, one of the cases I understand is pending. It can go on and on. And somewhere that is fact, that is knowledge, that is the truth that the court system should be allowed to get. It should be something that good, hardworking attorneys can pin people down and try and present the best case that they can by questioning what these opinions are. And when do opinions become facts? We're not here in this, I don't think, to hide secrets or hide those opinions. You know, I agree you don't pick up the yellow pages and say, you got to testify because you're a doctor and I got a case. And you know, nobody's going to do that because you're not going to get good testimony. But what you do want to do is get to the heart, the meat of what's going on with, in the case of doctors, the medical history itself. And I have a hunch it's going to be miserable if they can withhold opinions anytime they want to. As you say, one dies, one goes out of town, one of his peers in the clinic says, hey, you can't do that because Dr. So-and-so is a friend of mine. We golf together. All right, then I'm taking it back. I'm not going to testify anymore. I'll testify to what I saw. You know, and sometimes maybe the answer is to get rid of some of the expert testimony that's necessary. Let me just think of an example. A man who's driving his car. He gets his automobile crushed by being hit by a train. They take the jaws of life. They pull him out. They take him from there to the hospital. The doctor looks at him, works on him, sees what all the damage is he had, amputates his leg. Then it goes to trial. You think that the trial attorney feels comfortable saying, doctor, do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty as to what the cause of his injuries are? I mean, he just came from a train wreck. Doctor, do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty as to whether his loss of his leg is permanent? I mean, you almost feel foolish asking those questions. But now, under this rule, I'd have to go out and get another doctor. If that doctor refused to answer those questions, I'd have to pay another doctor to come in and answer those same stupid questions. And those are some things I think that it's going to take some insight as to all the problems that are going to evolve if a person doesn't have to be straightforward. There may be abuses somewhere, and maybe those abuses have to be curbed, as counsel said, whenever putting parameters on privileges. But those are a couple of the problems that I see. And I can, even in the court system, I can picture these treating doctors don't come to court and testify as to their opinions. Can't you just see a trial, a defense lawyer saying to the defendants would be arguing to the jury that although the plaintiff's treating doctor was here and told you about the injuries he treated, you probably noted that he didn't say that they were caused by the accident. What does he know that we don't know? Sure, Dr. X came in and said he thought it was probable that some of the injuries were related, but basically he's only telling you what his experience with others are, is he not, that he's treated and read about. Isn't that true? We had an independent doctor actually examine the plaintiff, and you did not hear him hammer haw or talk in possibilities, because he knows from hands-on experience that the claims are falsely related.
Mr. Brendel, your time is up. So,
okay.
Have something you have to say? Very quickly.
I'd just like to say one thing, if I may, for a minute. I have been a Wisconsin trial lawyer for almost 50 years. Graduating Valparaiso in 54, Marquette 56. I've appeared before this elite court on many occasions before, as over the spans of years, as some of you may know. I'm now retired already for almost a year, and will certainly not be lead counsel should you permit this case to go to trial. I want only to take a moment to impress upon each of you, perhaps only remind you, if necessary, that the legal system is to be open to all of the Wisconsin people, equally and fairly accessible, both reasonable expense, free of special preferences or financial status in life, and that the reason you are so revered by the citizens of this state with the title of justice is that they expect that you, gifted jurist, will uphold equal justice for all. Thank you for permitting me to appear.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Brossard. Mr. Russett, what do you think of the argument that privilege has never been invoked, so this is not right?
I think we need the correct decision. Need to look at the record here. While the doctor was never face to face in a deposition, he was never put on the stand at trial. The record is clear that he does not want to testify and act as an expert in this case. If you just think about the circumstances in which this arose, the trial court, we're here because the trial court issued an order compelling Dr. Coe to testify.
As an expert or just to testify?
To testify as to his opinions previously expressed, and he was named as a liability expert. Okay? So that order wouldn't be necessary if the trial court didn't believe that Dr. Coe was unwilling to testify. And if we look at the record, we're here because the case was adjourned 5 days before the trial date because plaintiff's counsel called the court and the parties and said that Dr. Coe was out of the country. If Dr. Coe was a willing participant in this litigation, would he have made plans to go out of the country during a period of time that he was expected to be in trial? If Dr. Coe was willing to be an expert witness, would he, in his very first letter to Judge Amato, say that at all times I had encouraged Mr. Brendel to find an expert witness out of Wisconsin, of which many are readily available, and I have given him names?
Names?
Names, except for professional plaintiff's witnesses Most doctors do not wish to play a leading role in any malpractice case against another local physician. Does that sound like a doctor who is going to testify? There's another letter from Dr. Cota, Mr. Brendel, in which he says very clearly, which is part of this record, I clearly stated at the time of the meeting that I would not be an expert witness as I was her treating physician. He goes on to say, it is my understanding that a good malpractice attorney would review the case and obtain his own expert witnesses. Again, he is very clearly stating, I'm not going to be an expert. I helped by supplying names of experts, and I do not believe they have not been followed up upon. And I do believe they have not been followed up upon. I'm very empathetic to Ms. Glenn's plight and exercised my duty by informing her that there was a possible case. The groundwork for and successful prosecution of her case is the responsibility of a good plaintiff's lawyer. I do not appreciate your attempt at a revisionist account of the circumstances nor the intimidatory remarks of the last two paragraphs. Intimidation is what he was referring to. I'm sorry, I couldn't pronounce the word. This does not sound like there is a relationship here where he is expected to appear at trial and provide testimony in support of the plaintiff's case.
Counsel, I'm just thinking of the scope of the privilege. Can he be required to testify? Can he be given a subpoena and required to testify as the treating physician?
He could be required to testify under Alt as to his observations in that role. Not as to his opinions, as to his pre-existing opinions, because Alt says that it isn't going to be compelled to give pre-existing opinions unless there's some compelling circumstance that makes him irreplaceable or uniquely necessary.
So he could, there's nothing as you read Alt that says he cannot be subpoenaed and be required to come to court as the treating physician. Doctor, did you see, much like his letter on page 149 of the appendix, and he performed extensive laparoscopy to free the bowel and other adhesions to her abdominal wall and pelvis, which were causing her pain. And since then, her pain has improved considerably, but she's still dealing with the fact she's now well with no pain, but is practically menopausal at age 27. I mean, can he be required as a treating physician to testify to those things that are in his record?
Well, that's what we're here about, Your Honor. We're here to find out whether he can be compelled to give the pre-existing opinions that he stated in his report.
Okay, I think we got to be on the same page here as to what and what cannot be done. I thought that you were arguing that he cannot be compelled to appear as an expert witness on liability. That's what he was named as, you told me.
Well, Your Honor, this letter, if I may interrupt, is his expert report on liability.
What I read to you was what he did as a treating physician, what he observed with regard to his patient and what the things he did. I grant you, a little later in that paragraph, he gives opinions that what was done by the other doctor wasn't appropriate. But I just read you, because I want to stay with this question, how wide do you think the scope of Alt versus Klein is? Can, under Alt versus Klein, can a treating doctor be required to testify as to what he observed and what he did in the course of his treatment?
I respectfully point out that that's not the circumstance in this case.
I know, but I want to know.
The circumstance of this case is about liability.
I know. I want to know what you're advancing, because there's something that suggested to me that you're saying that any treating that Alt versus Klein covers, and I don't know the answer to this, any treating physician. And
we're talking about Burnett, aren't we? Burnett versus Alt?
Well, another name is Alt versus Klein. It has two names. Is that what you're asserting? As a treating physician, not giving any expert opinion as to liability of another doctor, But as a treating physician, it's your interpretation of Ault versus Fine, that treating physician, qua treating physician, cannot be required to testify.
Again, this is not this case. I want to make that clear. And my opinion is that an expert, a treating physician who has opinions about his observations may be uniquely necessary. He may be irreplaceable. And so therefore, under Ault, he would be compelled to testify.
When you say he has opinions about his observations, I'm talking about, just like I read, what his observations were.
Let's take an example.
Can he describe what he saw when he performed a laparoscopic surgery and why he was doing that? I performed extensive laparoscopy to free bowel and other adhesions. Can he testify to that, to what he did?
An example would be if a physician is inside of a patient and is trying to determine whether it's healthy tissue or unhealthy tissue, he's got to formulate an opinion about that, based upon his observations. And under those types of circumstances, that physician may be irreplaceable. If there is no other expert that could take his observations and formulate opinions because he wasn't there, that physician is
irreplaceable. So your answer to my question is yes, that the scope of Ault versus Klein, because you're already applying the exception to the Ault versus Klein privilege. So you must think it comes a treating physician talking about what he did and what he saw, but offering no opinion whatsoever as to, MedMal or someone else's liability. A treating physician can raise a privilege and refuse to testify to what he did in treatment.
There's a difference between the facts of what he's done and the opinions he formulated in doing what he did.
Okay,
and I think that that's a very...
Because you're going to say if he says what he did, it's not covered by the privilege. If he gives an opinion, it is covered by the privilege. Is that your position?
I think that's what the Ault case says. Ault is a change in law from Filler, the expert was required to provide pre-existing opinions.
He can come and you can say to him, what days did she arrive? When did you see her? You can subpoena him to do that, right?
I think you can go into further detail. Yes.
All right. There were adhesions. Nothing said about what caused them. Can he testify as to that?
Yes.
Okay. So you're saying that he can't be forced to testify as to any opinions that he might have as a treating physician.
I think if you read Ault, that's what it says.
Well, what if he said...
We're just trying to...
If he said, I looked and there was some bad tissue? Now, bad is an opinion. Can he only say, I looked and there was tissue and I removed it? Or is he allowed to say, I looked at some tissue. It was diseased, which is an opinion, and I removed it. Are you saying...
I think he's allowed to say whatever he feels comfortable in saying. This is a privilege that he can exercise or choose not to exercise.
Well, because I assume that doctors who don't want to be involved, and I understand in many situations, who don't want to be involved are probably asserting their privilege. Treating doctors are asserting what they understand to be the privilege, which means they don't have to testify at all.
Well, let's use Mr. Brendel's example of the man in the train wreck and having his leg removed. He thinks it's outrageous that he should have to go out and hire another physician to give an opinion on permanency. Well, let's just take permanency in general. He thinks it's outrageous that the plaintiff should have to go out and hire another expert use the treating physician
the
as their expert.
Permanency, you need an expert. Non-permanency, you don't.
Right, but he thinks it's outrageous that they should have to go out and hire an independent expert to give a permanency opinion, whereas in the past they've always relied on the treating physician to give that opinion. If the treating physician decides that I'm going to limit the scope of my relationship with this patient to treating her and not get involved in litigation, why shouldn't the expert have that privilege?
Counsel, can I, since we're extending the time here, I just want to, my understanding of Brunette versus Ault was that in this case, the doctor could testify to what he saw and he did, but and if he was called and he agreed to do that, in any way he would have to if he was subpoenaed, but he would not could not be compelled to testify as to the standard of care. In other words, that's the rub, isn't it, Doctor?
That's correct. That's, yeah. That's what the question asked in Ault that Dr. Acosta refused to testify to was a question based upon the liability of the treating doctor.
But you read it broader than that.
I think that the case says, as a change from filler, that experts, and again, it's not just physicians, that experts are no longer required to give their pre-existing opinions.
That's
absent
right.
compelling circumstances, and I define compelling circumstances as the court did, that they're unique or irreplaceable. So in the circumstances where you have a treating physician, it may often be the case that those opinions are irreplaceable.
Okay.
But there may be another doctor who could take the same observations, the same facts, and reach the same opinions.
And that was the that's why the questioning was that, well, from what I read in the record in the letters, that I assumed that names were given and that they had the opportunity to have somebody else come in and testify to the standard of care.
I think it's very clear from the record that Dr. Koh does not want to be involved as a testifying doctor, expert on liability in this case.
But is the issue that's been raised is just what does ALT mean and how far and what is an opinion versus what is a fact and how the courts are interpreting that and how counsel are interpreting it. And that's really what you're raising to the court.
Well, what I'm raising, Your Honor, is that this circumstances can't be determined to be compelling.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Both Mr. Russert and Mr. Brendel for your arguments in a very important case for our judicial system as well as for professionals and others who are experts. That ends our hearing in 02-1426, Glenn versus Plant. The students will remain. Justice Rogensack will be out in a moment. Anyone else who wishes to attend the session, the justice is welcome, and additional students will be coming. Thank you. We are adjourned until 1:30.